Welcome to Studio 2, Week 10, right?
I think it is.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Later in the show, we'll be talking about safe streets, sharing the road with cyclists and pedestrians, implementing bike lanes, and decreasing traffic deaths. We want to hear from you. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We need safe streets, Avi.
And I know everyone listening is either a pedestrian, a cyclist, or a motorist, so this affects you. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. And in just a few minutes, we are also going to hear about the world's smallest pacemaker, just implanted at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. But before we get to all of that, Cherry, I'm going to check in with you. How was your long weekend?
It was very good. I needed it. Lots of family time.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. How about you?
It wasn't a long weekend for me, unfortunately. I was working yesterday, but it was a very nice weekend and also a lot of family time.
Yeah.
And the weather was ridiculously beautiful.
I know. And Memorial Day weekend is always iffy. So
right. That's true.
If you were in and around Philly, you probably saw a lot of tourists. That's like, you know, tourist season right now.
Mm-hmm. Kicking it off.
And so some sculptures around the city got a nice cleaning. They've been figuratively getting spit shined for the first time this year. I don't know if you know this, but I was shocked to learn that there's actual sculpture cleaning that goes on. The city wants the statues to be in top condition, and so this cleaning is necessary because the location of public art will determine what kind of care it needs. So if you notice, public art under trees can get really dirty and have pollen and stuff caked on it. If it's near traffic, it can be subject to black mold. And so there's a New York firm that comes down and they take care of these sculptures and pieces of public art every year. It's led by an art conservator named Zach Toddy. His family has been cleaning sculptures along the parkway and Rittenhouse Square and other parts of the city since the 80s. And when his dad made a deal with the Association for Public Art here. So now I'm going to be looking at these sculptures with a new level of appreciation.
Absolutely. I was not aware of this until the Inquirer did a story about it recently. And I was also fascinated. And it makes a lot of sense because if you step back and think about it, sculptures are like the face of a city often. Mm-hmm. So not just Philadelphia, you go to St. Louis and they got, you know, the arches, and I'm sure there's a million other examples. But public art, public displays are often sort of like what people associate with the city, whether it's the Love Sculpture. We did a podcast here at WHYY all about
the Rocky statue.
So it's nice that there's an effort, like an annual effort, to clean them, give them a little bath, make sure they're fresh and sparkly for us and others to enjoy.
Yeah, and you might see them along Kelly Drive because that's where we have a collection of them. And so don't be surprised if they have a little brush and, you know, cleaning these sculptures, making them beautiful again.
Speaking of things that are shiny and new, transition. The Sixers have hired a new coach, reportedly. Mm. It's not like official, but it's as official as it will be. They are hiring Nick Nurse to replace former head coach Doc Rivers. What do you want me to say about him, Cherry? You want to hear about Nick Nurse?
I want to hear about Nick Nurse after we got rid of Doc Rivers. Tell us about it.
So he led the Raptors, the Toronto Raptors, to their first ever NBA title in 2019. And during that run, by the way, they did defeat the Sixers. Mm-hmm. He's an interesting guy. He is sort of the opposite of Doc Rivers in some ways. Doc Rivers was a very good, longtime NBA player, and then like a long, long time head coach before becoming the head coach here for the Sixers. Nurse is like a grinder, sort of worked his way up through the coaching ranks, coached in England for a long time, in Belgium, and in the G League, which is like the NBA's minor leagues, and has really only been in the NBA either as an assistant or a head coach for the last decade. So this guy, you know, he is paid his dues, and he was the coach for the Raptors for a bit. It went well for a while, then not so good at the end, and now he's going to be the next guy here in Philly.
Well, I'm interested because, you know, because of the show and because I've been talking to you a lot, I've been watching more basketball, so you could like high-five me on that. I'm trying.
Sure.
I'm trying.
High-five.
But I was disappointed by the playoff outcome, so, you know, maybe this new coach is breath of fresh air.
Sure.
Someone who's been all over the world, you know, coaching, will bring a new perspective.
Maybe. I tend to think that coaching doesn't matter as much as fans think it matters, especially at the highest levels, because the players are so good and they're so intelligent and there's only so much sort of juice to squeeze. But this guy is very well thought of, and maybe he is the one to lead them to the promised land. I have my fingers crossed.
Promised land, we can see you. Let's see if we get there. So a few weeks ago, I don't know if you recall, we talked about the Philadelphia Parking Authority trying to help, you know, deal with the issue of people parking in bike lanes. Well, they sent bike patrol officers out on the streets to find those cars. The preliminary numbers are in. So can they get us to the promised land? That's the question, right? Well, since the rollout on May 1st, PPA's bike lane enforcement unit has issued 300 tickets to vehicles illegally parked in bike lanes. Remember, there are only 8 bike patrol officers. They're cruising Center City, University City, and South Philly. And those violations cost between $50 and $75. And of course, they're hoping to expand. 300 tickets in less than a month.
Is that a lot?
I don't know if that's a lot.
That's the problem. I have no idea if that's
a
lot.
Yeah, I don't know where to put it. But
there's no context
for it. If you're one of those people, it might be
a lot. Well, you shouldn't have parked in a bike lane.
I know. And we're going to be talking about bike safety and how to make the street safer for pedestrians as well later on. But
that's a little appetizer for that conversation.
Exactly. You got to learn. If you don't, you'll get hit in the pockets.
And before we get to our newsmaker interview, wanted to mention briefly a documentary that premiered on WHYY last night. I believe it was at 9:30 p.m. on TV 12. It's called Angel Dose, and it chronicles a man who at the time was a nurse, Tariq Khan, who went around Philadelphia during the COVID pandemic, basically with the suitcases full of COVID vaccines that were about to expire, and was trying to connect those soon to expire vaccines with people who needed them but had problems accessing care, often people who were homebound. It's an interesting documentary, 30 minutes. If you want to learn more about it before you watch it, we actually have a write-up right now at BillyPenn.com by Heather Chin that explains the doc and gives you some insights into it. And it's an interesting watch. Again, it's called Angel Dose, premiered last night.
By the way, I met Tariq Khan when he was going door-to-door when I was used to be a reporter. He used some of the momentum that came around him sort of doing this work to run for the Pennsylvania House of Representatives. And he won, last year. So he unseated a 6-term incumbent. So now we call him Representative Khan. There
Representative Khan. That's what I was kind of teasing earlier.
Yeah.
No, I was saying at the time of the documentary, Tariq Khan was a nurse. Although very early in the doc, if you watch it, he alludes to this idea that he's going to run for office. So it was clearly what was happening. The wheels were already in motion for that as he was being, tailed by this documentary crew. But anyways, interesting watch and, of course, a reminder that the COVID pandemic was a stress test for our health system in many ways. And it passed some tests and it failed others. And here was this person trying to fill one of the gaps that had emerged. So you learn about the health system writ large by watching this one guy's journey.
Yeah, very interesting. And speaking of the health system,
yes, let's get into
it. We're going to transition over to our newsmaker for today. Children's Hospital of Philadelphia recently implanted the smallest pacemaker in the world to help a baby that's just 6 months old with a heart condition. Our guest is Dr. Maoli Shah, a pediatric cardiac electrophysiologist at CHOP. I hope that I said that right. And she is here with us. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Shah, can you first tell us about baby Cameron and why he needed a pacemaker?
Yes. Baby Cameron is born with a very rare heart condition called congenital complete heart block. It occurs in about 1 in 20,000 individuals. And if you were to take a normal newborn who is heartbeat is about 150 beats a minute, Cameron's heartbeat was only 50 beats per minute. And in addition to the extremely low heart rate, he also had additional breathing and feeding problems. And the only way to give him the best chance for recovery was to implant a pacemaker.
And so let's explain how a pacemaker works and could help with baby Cameron.
So the way a pacemaker works is that it's a device which has a battery, a sensor, and an electronic circuit that sends an electrical impulse to the heart to generate a heartbeat. And we can program a desired heart rate on the pacemaker that would mimic a normal heart rate for someone who's Cameron's age.
And so how did you build this device? Because my understanding is you had to build it. There was not a pacemaker available that would have worked in this situation. So how did you go about creating the specific type of pacemaker that Cameron needed?
What's available for children as well as adults is a one-size-fits-all pacemaker. Basically, pacemakers are built and designed for the adult body and heart. Now, in 2016, the FDA approved what is now known as the world's smallest pacemaker, but that pacemaker is intended to be implanted inside the heart of an adult. And in order to implant this tiny pacemaker, you need very large catheters, which are again made for adults and not suitable for implantation in babies. So what we did was we worked with the manufacturer of the pacemaker. We took that very tiny pacemaker and adapted it to be implanted in a child. So this would now be surgically implanted. The manufacturer was able to use 3D printing to build an envelope around this tiny pacemaker, so we could now connect it to wires, and the wires could then be connected to the heart. So the pacemaker itself is implanted in the muscular structure of the abdomen, and the wires are then tunneled to the heart through a very small incision.
Wow, and kudos on creating this device to help this young patient. But it must have been a very difficult decision for Cameron's mom. Like, how do you talk to a parent about the options and the unknowns when you're having to create something that has, you know, that hasn't necessarily been, or do something that hasn't necessarily been done before?
Very honestly and frankly. So we pitched this idea to Cameron's mom, and we had a frank conversation that the kind of device we would implant in Cameron was not FDA approved for that type of implantation. Mm. So even though the pacemaker itself was FDA approved and has been tested inside the heart, the technique and the modification was not FDA approved, but we would be able to possibly get a humanitarian exemption. Now there are, Cameron is number 10, so there were 9 other children prior to Cameron where this pacemaker had been implanted, and in a very short term, the results were good, but it was still untested for the long term. But when you look at the size of a conventional pacemaker, which is much larger, weighs 25 grams, as opposed to this tiny little pacemaker that only weighs 2 grams, there were really no downsides except that it wasn't tested long term. And I think Cameron's mother is, you know, a lot of credit to her. She's been by his bedside every day, is very involved in his care, was able to see those advantages, and could see how his recovery would be much quicker with a smaller incision and a smaller device, taking into account his other medical problems.
And we have about 10 seconds. Can you just tell us very quickly what his prognosis is in the near term?
I am very optimistic. Cameron's making progress every single day. He's getting stronger, healthier. He's a normal child. He smiles at us, smiles at his mother. So he has a long road, but he's going to be fine.
That's wonderful. That is Dr. Mally Shaw, a pediatric cardiac electrophysiologist at CHOP. Coming up, we are talking about safer streets. Stay with us on Studio 2.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. And I want to start this segment by reading you some recent headlines from our news partner 6ABC. Two injured in head-on crash on Broad Street, cars mangled. Man fights for his life after a crash of dirt bike into car in Philly. Woman arrested in connection with deadly hit-and-run spree. All of those headlines, Cherry, within the last 5 days, and that is truly just a sampling.
Yeah, very scary. And behind the headlines are the stats. The number of pedestrians and cyclists killed nationwide rose in 2022. And here in Philadelphia, more than 120 people lost their lives due to traffic accidents last year. All of this is a little nerve-wracking if you've been wanting to ditch your car to walk or ride to work.
Philadelphia, if you didn't already know, has a Vision Zero plan with a bold goal. That zero means zero fatalities and serious injuries by 2030. To get there, the city is altering roadways, installing speed cameras. Our friends at Billy Penn recently detailed Philadelphia's first attempt at a curb-protected bike lane in Old City.
Yeah, and here to help us understand what needs to be done to achieve a safer city for cyclists, pedestrians, and yes, even drivers, are Nicole Brunet, Policy Director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia, and Kelly Yeeman from the City of Philadelphia's Complete Streets program. Welcome to Studio 2.
Before we jump in, we want to remind our listeners that you can call or email us with your questions. What do you think needs to be done to make you feel safer on the sidewalk, in the crosswalk? The number is 888-477-9499. The email address is studio2@whyy.org.
And Nicole, I want to start with you because Philadelphia was just voted the most walkable city by some readers at USA Today. Mm-hmm. Yet we just heard some very concerning headlines and stats. Can you put all of this in context? In other words, how can we be seen as one of the most walkable cities in the country, but at the same time be dangerous for pedestrians and cyclists?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have the opportunity to be the best city to walk in, to ride a bike, to choose public transit. I don't think we're there yet. Obviously, we're going to talk about improvements we can make to the roadway. But what we've seen in the pandemic is a huge increase in speeding and reckless driving behaviors. And there really is a cultural moment that's conflicting a perfect place to walk with dangerous and reckless behavior.
Kelly, I wanted to bring you into the conversation here. Explain for those folks who haven't heard about it what Vision Zero is and sort of more practically what it entails, you know, outside of the philosophy and the goal, but like what are some of the things that people are going to see around them that are part of Vision Zero?
Yeah, so Vision Zero is the city's program to get to zero fatalities on our roadways and make our roads safer for everyone. We do that through changing how our roadways work, so adding protected bicycle lanes, pedestrian improvements. You might have seen medians on North Broad Street to protect pedestrians in the intersections. It also includes new enforcement measures like automated speed cameras that have been working on Roosevelt Boulevard and dramatically decreasing speeding and speeding-related fatalities on that roadway. It also includes education. So how do we get into our schools? And we have a program, Safe Routes Philly, to help educate our kindergartners, our pre-K to fifth grade kids on how to walk and bike and get around their city safely. And we'll be expanding that to older grades in the future. So it's really looking at these three legs of a stool of education, enforcement, and engineering and how we design our streets and how do they support each other to create a safer Philadelphia.
Yeah, and just sort of responding to the Vision Zero program, they're seeking to solve certain problems. Can you just lay out what those problems are and what seems to be some of the major causes of these incidents. And I'm sure we just talked about the deadly ones, but there's probably many more where people survive and are just injured.
Yeah. The major cause for a fatal or serious injury in most cases involving a car is speeding. And there's a lot we can do to change the way the road looks like to discourage people from speeding. That could be a road diet, decreasing the number of lanes on the road, adding more protective spaces for vulnerable users, so increasing the pedestrian space or creating separated or parking protected bike lanes for bike users. So it's about changing the landscape of the road so speeding isn't something that you want to do. And yes, there are people that drive recklessly, but there's also streets that enable that reckless driving.
Give me an example of a street in Philadelphia. We always hear about the Roosevelt Boulevard in the Northeast. Yeah. But give me a sense of what a poor street design, I'm actually going to direct this to you, Kelly, what a poor street design looks like and what a good street design looks like from a safety perspective. Give me some contrasting visions here.
Well, I mean, I think the Roosevelt Boulevard is you know, something that's changed and evolved. It wasn't even an intentional design so much as something that was added onto over time and has become this very large, very fast roadway. So the near-term improvement has been to put in the speed cameras and get those speeds down. We just received a large mega grant from the federal government to do near-term improvements on the boulevard coming from our Route for Change program. So that's $80 million worth of federal dollars coming to help improve Roosevelt Boulevard, upgrade those designs. And then, bigger changes for potentially the future. I think a comparison we have right here in Center City are JFK and Market Streets in Center City. Those were used to be four lanes of traffic each. We've slowly reduced it by adding a protected bike lane. We've added transit lanes. And now we've seen speeding decrease, safety increase, reduced crashes, reduced fatalities, and, again, lowering the speed limit or the speeding that is happening on those streets in off hours. A lot of times it's not the peak hour. It's not rush hour where we have our problems. It's 8 o'clock at night. It's midnight where
people
drivers
see that open
go
pavement.
So
yeah.
fast.
Yeah.
So narrowing it to make sure it meets, we're not creating congestion in the peak hour, but it's just barely there. So in the off hours, you don't have that really bad behavior that results in fatalities.
And so I think about Roosevelt Boulevard. And I mean, it's 12 lanes in some places. People are trying to get across the street. When you push the button to get help, you can't get off. Can you talk about, do we have other main areas like that? And how are we, and what's been the advocacy point of trying to bring attention to those areas so that you reduce fatalities?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing from our perspective is, yes, we want to reduce the crossing speed on roads like Roosevelt Boulevard. It's 12 lanes. You're correct there. And then remind people that people live right there. It's not just an arterial to take people from Center City or 76 outside the city. People live there. They have to cross that street. They have to cross that street to visit their friends, to go to rec centers, to go, to spend time with their family. And those people are the ones feeling the outsized negative experience from the speeding and reckless driving. Other roads that are similar to this are Cobbs Creek Parkway, Broad Street, Ridge Avenue. These arterial roads with cars moving way too fast, running directly through communities, and communities that have felt a brunt of a lot of bad decisions within our history, that have been disenfranchised, and they're feeling all of this every day.
Lower income, people of color tend to face the brunt of that,
You talked about history there, Nicole. I was surprised to find this doing some research, but if you wind the clock back to about 1990, there's some research from folks at Rutgers and Virginia Tech. Pedestrian fatalities in the U.S. per capita, really not that far off from major Western European countries, Denmark, the U.K., Netherlands. Then it seems over the last 30 years there's been this divergence. Those countries have continued to bring those fatalities down. The U.S. has come down a little bit, but not nearly to the same degree. So why the divergence? What went wrong here? Is it something within our control, or is it something structural about the U.S.?
It's all within our control. The car size has gotten bigger. Cars go faster. And there is a disconnect between people driving the cars and the everyone else around. And I really do think it's a cultural shift where we've seen other countries start to increase safety measures. So increase safety measures on the road, increase safety measures within cars, as well to restrict the size of vehicles. Mm. Plays a big role.
Yeah. And if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Nicole Brunet, Policy Director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia, and Kelly Yeeman from the City of Philadelphia's Complete Streets Program. We want to hear from you. What do you think needs to be done to help make you feel safer on the sidewalk or if you're riding your bike? The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. We have a caller on the line, Mia. Her husband was hit by a biker. So we want to talk about culture a little bit. Mia, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi there. So my husband actually wasn't hit. He was almost hit. He was crossing Chestnut Street, and he had the right of way in terms of the light, and a bicyclist who blew through the light coming in the other direction almost hit him, and he sort of jumped out of the way, fell backwards, hit the back of his head on Chestnut Street, was unconscious. He sustained 4 brain bleeds and actually was in the hospital in the intensive care unit when our daughter got married 2 days later. Mm-hmm. he now has seizure disorder, and otherwise he's okay, thank God. But I want to point out that traffic laws are very important to obey for motorists, for bicyclists, and for pedestrians.
Thank you very much, Mia. I want you to respond to that because I, too, almost was hit by a bike just the other day. Is this an issue with the way pedestrians culturally act, the way bikers culturally act, or is it all on motorists?
I believe that everyone needs to be paying attention when they're on the road. And that's an awful thing to happen. I'm so sorry to hear that. As a road user, you have the responsibility to pay attention and ride safely or drive safely and pay attention to the most vulnerable user, which in this scenario is the pedestrian crossing the street and having the right of way. The intersection is the biggest place that we're seeing conflicts. And I know as personally as a cyclist, you want to get through the intersection before the cars because that's where you're in the most conflict zone. But the most vulnerable user, like I said, is the pedestrian in this situation. So it is totally on the cyclist to also be watching the pedestrians crossing the street, watching the lights, and making sure they're moving through the intersection safely themselves.
Yeah,
Kelly Yeeman, I want to bring you back in the conversation building off of that. Electric bikes, electric scooters, there seems to be this ever-growing number of devices that can move people through a congested city pretty quickly. How is that complicating your job? Is it complicating your job? Or perhaps it's taking people out of your cars and making your job easier. How do you reckon with the rise of these electric bikes and electric scooters?
Well, it's definitely both. It's both making our jobs easier and harder in different ways. As you said, we've seen a lot of movement out of vehicles onto when people get an e-bike. And because it makes traveling around the city and longer distances easier, or using a cargo bike to be able to carry more weight or kids, like a minivan. That said, they go a lot faster, and how they navigate the roadways, the trails, and our bike lanes is, a complicating factor. And I think something a lot of cities are adjusting to right now. I don't think we have a solid answer as far as how to govern them in fleets. Like Indigo, we can make sure that they can only go at a top speed that is more reasonable. Privately owned vehicles and how they're either souped up or modified, that can be its own issue.
Can I follow up on that real quickly? The traffic calming that we know with research works to reduce speeds of cars. Does it also prove effective at reducing speeds of people on electric bikes or electric scooters who might be going too fast?
Yeah, so some of the things we'll use on, you can see over on the Delaware Trail, the new section is what we call bike safe rumble strips. These are, instead of the big rumble strips you might see at a toll plaza, these are gentler ones because you've got a smaller vehicle, but still have that same effect of giving a rumble to the bicyclist to be like, you're approaching a pedestrian area, slow down. So we'll take things and modify them to be appropriate for a bicycle, maybe adding curves in a street that just cause them to slow down, adding you know, some inclines as they approach intersections, depending on what works at that given location to get people to slow down as they're approaching an intersection, just like we would a vehicle.
Wonderful. That voice you just heard is that of Kelly Yeaman from the City of Philadelphia's Complete Streets program. We're also speaking with Nicole Brunet, Policy Director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. We want to hear from you. Call us. Talk about what you think needs to be done so you can feel safer on the sidewalk. The number is 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org. I want to bring in a comment from Leo. He's a Lyft driver who says, I agree, there are so many bikers who flagrantly disobey laws. I want to talk about this particular issue, and I think Avi touched on it a little bit, but you have all these different devices. You got scooters, you got people on, you know, they're doing all kinds of, you got bikes. A lot of times people don't even have any kind of safety training. What is being done to educate people who all they have to do is swipe and get access to all sorts of smaller vehicles, and they could be putting themselves and others in danger? What kind of training is being done?
Yeah, so we have an education program. We have a partnership with Indigo. So we combine to do learn to ride classes. In the past, we've done urban riding basics classes. We have put out a bunch of materials in 6 languages and connected with communities about safe riding. But what you're getting at is a really big issue. When you buy a car, you get airbags, mm-hmm. you get a seatbelt, you get lights. When you get a bike, you don't get anything. You have to buy your own helmet. Maybe you'll get lights. So these are things that we want to promote. In many of our classes, we'll give out free helmets. And we also have bike hubs throughout the city. So there's a bike hub up in Hunting Park that runs on Saturdays during the summer. We also have a bike hub at Bartram's Garden that is on Friday and Saturdays in the spring and summer. And we do bike light giveaways to give out lights during daylight savings. So when you see a dramatic change in the light. But we do what we can to educate cyclists. But, you know, like I said, everyone is responsible as a road user. And the number of, I will say just the number of drivers that impact cycling and make it a dangerous place to be it's alarming. And yes, I want to see cyclists ride safer and respect rules of the road, but it goes both ways.
It definitely
but,
does.
But what is the best way to ride? Here's an email from Mary who asks, what is the attitude cyclists should take when riding alongside cars and trucks? One cyclist I know says riding big is the way to go, riding with confidence, trusting that vehicles will see you. How do we best ride in traffic? I want you to answer that, Nicole, but I think on top of that, even though I see the research that says cars are really the big problem here and cars moving at high speeds, a lot of motorists will say there just seems like a fairness imbalance here. They're always breaking the law and I'm more following the law and it's not fair that I'm being blamed. I hear motorists express that. Mm-hmm. I want you to speak to those people.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us how cyclists should ride, but also speak to those skeptical motorists who think that there is sort of a blame the car person culture.
Yeah. As a cyclist, you need to be predictable. So, you know, ride in the center of the lane, use hand signals when you're turning. As much as it's possible, try to make eye contact with drivers, which becomes more and more difficult as we see tinted windows. I can't make eye contact with people. I don't know if people see me. The biggest issue I have riding around Center City is that I legally am riding in the middle of the lane and a car driver pushes me out of the way because they think I shouldn't be there. So you see more aggressive riders because they get pushed out by multi-ton vehicles and get put into danger. So there is definitely an action that's been created from previous actions.
Right. That's a bad cycle there.
Yeah, it is. It is. And so I would like drivers. Drivers, listen.
Listen up, drivers.
Yeah.
Cyclists, a bicycle is a vehicle. They are allowed to take the lane. Do not push them out of the lane. It is terrifying. One of my coworkers was pushed out of a lane and injured himself last week. It happens all the time.
It happened to me today biking into work, so yeah. I totally understand.
So I think that is a really big issue, is seeing that we are also a vehicle, and we, and if in order for us to be good road users, you have to treat us with respect. So it does go both ways. And cyclists, you should also, like I said, be predictable. Use hand signals. Take up the lane the way you're supposed to. And driver and cyclist behavior will change.
Yeah. And I want to bring in this comment from Chris, who says, I have to pay for a license and pass a test as a driver. When I was young, I used to have to take a bicycling rider's course. If cyclists are getting so many more rights, should they be required to take some type of a course or a safety training? Or,
I mean, I think that everyone should get safety training. I think requiring a license for a bicyclist is anti-low class and anti-people of color, because a bicycle is a cheaper mode of transportation. It's a mode of transportation that you can use without having a license, even if, like, maybe you're not legally allowed to have a license. You can ride a bike. And it definitely, I think that is just anti-low class behavior.
Yeah.
Kelly, can I bring you back into the conversation? Look, we're getting a lot of comments about the bicycle motorist thing, and that's what clearly some of the listeners want to talk about. But we don't want to ignore the structural stuff. I want you to explain to people, what are the big obstacles the city faces in trying to do more traffic calming quicker? Is it money? Is it opposition from community groups? Is it just time? I mean, what is preventing you from moving as fast as possible on this?
Well, I think, you know, it is always money. and we are very fortunate with the bipartisan infrastructure law that is bringing in, I mean, we've received over $140 million worth of federal grants in just the past year to go towards safety improvements all across the city. But in the end, it's still a drop in the bucket for the needs. Whether that's on the Roosevelt Boulevard, on neighborhood streets, through our Great Streets PHL grant, through improvements that are going to come to Cecil B. Moore and North Broad Street. We're taking advantage of every paving opportunity, but the both the staff resources to be able to do all the community engagement that you want to do, make sure you're getting the community buy-in, because projects are only as good as the neighborhood that buys into it and really believes in what's happening. So you need to spend time with people understanding what the issues are that they're facing in their neighborhoods, and then really responding to it, not just blindly following the data. So you're bringing those two things together. That takes time and resources, let alone the infrastructure to actually build all of that.
And quick follow-up to that, Kelly. Do we have the political will to get this done? And what is sort of what's in the city's power wheel, and what's in is beyond the city's control?
Yeah, we only have so much control of the system, right? We can redesign a lot of our streets, but we don't own even all of our roadways. Many are owned by the state, by PennDOT. And so we're working with a great partnership with PennDOT, but they have state rules that must be followed on those roadways. We can't set our own speed limits. That is dictated by state law. We can't put speed cameras everywhere. That is a pilot that is on Roosevelt Boulevard right now. It would be an effective, amazingly effective tool, and we've seen that in other cities, to expand speed enforcement onto other corridors in the city. And that is something that, you know, we see as a huge Vision Zero improvement that we would love to see passed out of Harrisburg. There's the size of vehicles, as Nicole talked about, the size of SUVs and how large trucks and SUVs are comparatively to where we were in the 90s. Back to that question, the size of vehicles, and can you see a child from what distance?
Yeah.
Those cars have increased enormously so that you can't even see anybody. Having the ability to control that at the federal level would make a huge difference in safety.
So many different avenues to pursue. That's where we leave the conversation for today. Thank you for joining us on Studio 2. Kelly Yeaman is the director of Complete Streets. Nicole Brunet is the policy director at the Bicycle Coalition of Greater Philadelphia. Thank you to both of you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking about artificial sweeteners. There's some new warnings about them. Stay tuned.
This is Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
Hello, everybody. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The World Health Organization issued guidelines this month against using artificial sweeteners. And the WHO didn't just say they lack nutritional value. No, no, no. They listed potential undesirable effects like cardiovascular disease. Now, when you think about these artificial sweeteners, you might picture the little yellow packet in your coffee, maybe diet soda. But the game, Cherry, has changed. These ingredients can be found everywhere.
I know. After preparing for today's interview, I did a check this morning, and my pantry, unfortunately, has so many items with these ingredients. So we're going to break it all down, the new WHO guidelines, and talk about these addicting ingredients and where they can be found with Washington Post Eating Lab columnist Anahad O'Connor. Anahad O'Connor, welcome to Studio 2.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're excited to have you. I want to start first by defining what an artificial sweetener is, and then I want you to answer whether or not it matters if it's synthetic or, quote, a natural substitute.
Yeah, so first off, you know, we generally refer to these compounds as artificial sweeteners, but there are a lot of them that are not artificial. So actually, a lot of health experts refer to them oftentimes as non-nutritive sweeteners. That's because you have the traditional artificial sweeteners like aspartame and sucralose and saccharin. But then there are these newer generation of, let's say, diet sweeteners like stevia and monk fruit extract, which are actually derived from plants.
Give me a sense of what this stuff is in, because I understand it's, like we said, it's not just diet sodas anymore. What types of foods are these sweeteners in that maybe might surprise us?
Yeah, so the game has really changed. You know, decades ago, it was common for people to consume, you know, have these or consume these diet sweeteners in things like Diet Pepsi, Diet Coke, or, you know, the little packets of artificial sweeteners on, you know, the table at the local diner that you might put into your coffee or drink, whatever. But as public health experts have increasingly urged people to cut back on the amount of added sugars in their foods, you know, things like sucrose and high fructose corn syrup, food companies, it turns out, there's been this unintended effect of food companies removing real sugar from their foods and using artificial and these other sweeteners in their foods to replace the real sugar. And so you're not just seeing them in diet sodas anymore, or in these little sweet, you know, sweetener packets. You're seeing them in just a really broad array of processed foods, things like bread, yogurt, oatmeal, muffins. A lot of foods that people might think of as healthy contain these things. So I took a walk through my local grocery store a couple weeks ago, and I was just stunned at the foods that I found them in. Even salad dressings and ketchup and snack bars have just a wide variety of these diet sweeteners. And sometimes it's not just one diet sweetener in these products. It's two or three or more of them.
Wow. I found them in almost every type of protein bar that I had in my pantry this morning. So I want to just sort of get an understanding of the impact of these sweeteners, because at one point we thought we knew what they did, but there's I want you to just sort of explain metabolically what these sweeteners do to us to trick us into to tasting the sweetness.
Yeah. So traditionally, scientists thought of these things as inert, you know, that we consume them, they pass through our body, and that's the end of it. And that they have this, you know, great effect of giving us the sweetness without the calories. So what could go wrong? But as they've looked more closely at these substances and how they act in the human body, they have found these very surprising effects. So there was one study that, you know, found that these diet sweeteners can actually change the makeup of your gut microbiome. And your gut microbiome refers to the trillions of, you know, bacteria, viruses, and other microbes in your gut that help us digest and metabolize food, and they produce hormones, and they just have a wide range of effects on our health. So these sweeteners do affect our gut microbiome. There have been studies showing that they And used in the long term, they can increase your risk of developing cardiovascular disease, diabetes, and other chronic diseases. There are researchers who say that when you consume a lot of these things, they're so intensely sweet that they can increase your tolerance for sweet foods and make you crave more sweet foods. There have been some studies suggesting that they can impact things like your blood sugar regulation and insulin resistance, which is a precursor to diabetes. So there's been a lot of alarming sort of potential side effects uncovered of these products. And one of the issues with the research is just that there are so many of them that it's really hard to untangle how they affect us. And it's hard to do really long-term studies following people for many years.
However, I was reading a piece by this really smart guy named Anahad O'Connor in the Washington Post, and it mentioned that there were some clinical trials that suggest some of these sweeteners won't reduce weight, but can maybe stem weight gain, as opposed to if, you know, we were just doing the full sugar version. So should I be drinking Diet Coke? Should I be drinking Coke Classic? Give us a sense of how a consumer should approach this moving forward.
That guy does make a really good point. let me address that. So the WHO, you know, wants people to move away from these, you know, artificial sweeteners, these non-nutritive sweeteners, and move toward real food. You know, they initially started with guidelines telling people to cut back on the added sugars in their foods. And now they're saying cut back on these, you know, non-nutritive sweeteners. And instead of drinking soda or diet soda, drink, you know, water flavored with lemon or, you know, tea or coffee, other things that don't have these sweeteners. They want us to reduce the overall sweetness of our diet, because if you think about these artificial sweeteners and non-nutritive sweeteners, they're sort of a marker for ultra processed foods. You don't find these things in real foods like fruits and vegetables and nuts and seeds. And they want people to improve their overall diet and just kind of cut back on all this sweetness, which is kind of a new thing in human evolution. We didn't used to consume all of this, you know, these really sweet foods essentially. But you know, these guidelines have been controversial because there are a lot of health experts, you know, who have been urging people to cut back on soft drinks, you know, like Coca-Cola, which we know are really bad for you. They're loaded with all sorts of real sugars. And so some health experts say that for people who drink a lot of, let's say, Coke or Pepsi loaded with sugar, if you need something to sort of to help you get past your
wean
sugar
yourself
fix, maybe
off,
switch
yeah.
from wean yourself off, exactly. Then you can switch from, you know, real Coke to Diet Coke and use it just as a sort of fix, sort of like a smoker who's trying to quit cigarettes and they need a nicotine patch, right? Yeah. Like, it's not something you want to do forever, but it will help you get past your addiction or your dependence. And so there are some health experts who say, yeah, we do want to get people off of diet sodas, but for those who are addicted to real sodas or maybe dependent on them, this can be a sort of short-term fix. And there are some studies that show that in the short term, at least, if you have a group of people who's drinking, you know, full sugar soda, and you compare them to a group of people who are drinking artificially sweetened sodas, then the people who are drinking the diet sodas, they actually do gain less weight than the people drinking real soda. But the people who do the best when it comes to body weight are the people who switch from soda, any sort of sweet drink, artificially sweetened or not, to water. The people drinking water do the best when it comes to weight loss.
And Anahad, I want to get one last question in because we only have less than 30 seconds. But, you know, your advice for folks who try to look at the label, I could barely tell what was in it. Your advice for folks who are trying to avoid these artificial sweeteners, what do you tell them?
Yeah, so there's so many out there, and food companies are sort of depending on us not knowing the names of these things in order to get us to consume them. So look for, you know, try to avoid ultra processed or packaged foods, especially the ones that make health claims. They might say reduced sugar or, you know, they might even say no artificial sweeteners, but then they'll have something like stevia or monk fruit extract. So be wary of these health claims. Look at the back of these products. Look at the list of ingredients and familiarize yourself. If you see something that you don't recognize, like monk fruit extract or, you know, acesulfame K, look it up and find out what it is before you buy it or eat it.
Perfect advice. Thank you so much. That's Washington Post Eating Lab columnist Anahad O'Connor. Thank you for joining us on Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
Of course, you can head to whyy.org/studio2 for more and find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our producers are Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Our engineer is Al Banks from WHYY in Philadelphia. My name is Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Have a great afternoon.